Before we begin today's interview with the author of Dr. Nicholas Gonzalez's official biography, somebody recently asked me a question that I thought was worth sharing. They asked, is Dr. Gonzalez's biography full of hard-to-understand medical language? Well, I just smiled. Because the truth is, it's full of words like organic foods, vitamin D, grass-fed beef, fresh carrot juice. In other words, it's about what real healing actually looks like. And it's also about what a real hero looks like. Today, I am joined by someone who didn't just write about this work, she lived it. Mary Swander is the award-winning author of The Maverick MD, the official biography of my late husband, Dr. Nicholas Gonzalez. And what makes this conversation so unique is that Mary was also a patient for decades. She came to Dr. Gonzalez with severe immune disorders and experienced firsthand what it means to commit and benefit from a protocol most people don't fully understand. So today, this is not just a conversation about a book. It's a conversation about courage, belief, discipline, healing, and what happens when somebody refuses to give up on finding answers. Mary, welcome to Your Way Back. So Mary, I think a lot of people are going to want to know, what first drew you to want to tell Dr. Gonzalez's story?
Well, I found it such a fascinating new paradigm. Actually, it's an old paradigm, but a new paradigm in medicine as far as contemporary medicine goes. And I actually wanted to write a book about him years before that, when I was just beginning to work with him, because I could see he was one of the smartest people I'd ever run into. And he was doing something remarkable that nobody seemed to know about. And I remember I said, I think I'd like to write a book about you. You know, he didn't want it written at the time. And so I let that go. And then after he passed away, I thought, oh, no, now we have to have a book because we have to preserve his legacy. We have to let people know what this program is, what it's about, and the success that it's had, and the scientific rigor that's behind the program. So I hope to take all those things on in the book.
So Mary, you obviously knew Nick for decades. When you began the book project, what surprised you the most about his life that you didn't expect?
I found it fascinating that he had been a journalist. I knew he'd been a journalist, but it was so much fun for me to dig into that part because I am a writer too, and I could see all the challenges and things that he had to cope with as a writer. And then when he shifted his career, that part I was not certain about, and he shifted his career and became a doctor, I thought, oh boy, how did he do that? And I realized quickly that he was of such superior intelligence that he could have probably done anything. You know, he could have studied anything, done anything that he put his mind to and been a raging success. And it was just that people like Linus Pauling gave him the nudge, gave him the push. You know, he was out there interviewing Nobel Prize winners and they're saying, what medical school did you go to, son? And he's like, oh, I don't have a medical degree. And I have a degree in English literature, which I just love that, you know. And they're like, well, you got to go to medical school. And then he ended up in medical school without even, you know, doing a formal pre-med program. So he had to go back and pick up science courses. And he moved back home, lived with his parents, and rode the subway forever and a day into Manhattan and took his courses. And of course, he aced all those. And I remember I came across this line. He said, well, people didn't think I'd be any good at math, but I seemed to be able to handle that just fine. So he, as I say, he could handle anything just fine. And then he went on to medical school. And then he met Kelly and his life took another turn. That's what fascinated me. I was like, okay, this is a person who's so smart that his mind is open. You know, I know a lot of smart people, and they're smart in one little avenue, and then they exclude everything else. Like, they don't pursue thinking about any other idea or venue to investigate. And he was so smart that he was like, oh, okay, let me investigate this. Oh, this is interesting, but I don't think it'll work, but okay, let me investigate that. And then I just love little details that you gave me in particular. I had no idea he was obsessed with finding a way to address male baldness. I was like, oh, that one is just totally out of the box. And he was putting different lotions on top of his head and had a bandana tied around his forehead, doing this at home, right, when he was so-called off work.
And it worked. He actually would put this liquid on his head, and we would take a little nail brush, and I could flick the hairs. They'd literally pop out of his scalp. It was incredible. A lot of work, because you got to do like hair by hair by hair. But he figured it out. So, Mary, you had access to Dr. Gonzalez's personal world. You interviewed his patients for your preparation for writing his official biography. You learned all about his struggles, his thinking. What do you think that you came to understand about him that the public never saw?
I think that was his spirituality. He was so dedicated to aligning himself with a higher power, a sense of the divine in his work. And that was interesting. Like I went to him for 20 years. And so I had, before he passed away. And so I had a good insight into him. And once in a while, he would, you know, let out a little line or two to me that I thought, I remember when I was really, really, really sick and having a lot of trouble, and I'd been in another car accident and paralyzed. And he said, now, you and I both began, you know, our life with our Catholic faith. And so you need to get back in touch with that. And, you know, he would say little things like that. I was like, okay, I can do that. But, you know, I didn't see that in the office that much. And then the more I wrote the book, the more profound it became to me.
I think that he mentioned it to patients when he felt like it was appropriate, but he did not want it to ever feel inappropriate for people. So, because it really was about the science for him. So I'm curious, knowing him so well for so many years, and we're going to get into your personal experience as his patient in a minute. But I'm curious, did you see him as a rebel or as a scientist who was simply refused to ignore evidence?
Well, both, really. I mean, he was a dedicated scientist. He was a dedicated physician. He loved the medical model. Like, he loved medical school. And when I talked to a couple of his assistants, and there was one where he wanted her to go to medical school and study straight medicine and then eventually come to work for him. And she was just like, he thought medical school was the thing to do. It really taught him how to think, how to investigate, how to be a scientist. But at the same time, he thought he was onto something. He was. And that he had a system that could address cancer in a different way. I also saw him. I saw him take phone calls where he told patients, no, for this, you need to go get chemo. There's no sense in doing my program because chemo can help you. Goodbye. And I thought, well, that's interesting too. So he was the rebel in that he didn't just take the standard word as gospel. And he would talk about Kelly, the dentist that he learned this from, with both amusement and total reverence. I mean, he thought Kelly was a complete genius who broke open a paradigm.
As his wife for 15 years, you know, what I noticed is that he not only had intense curiosity for this work, but also intense conviction for making sure that it was done properly and documented properly. Now, where do you think that motivation came from? There's a section in the book where you talk about Dr. Gonzalez's father's death, and I'd like to hear more about that experience.
Well, he was very close to his father, and they had a real bonding father-son relationship. I mean, I think it was just really touching and, you know, and close and a model for people, parents. And his father, I could tell, had, you know, knew that Nick could do great things in the world. He knew that. And I think his mother did too, of course. And he, from what I gathered from interviewing the rest of his family, the father was like supportive of whatever he wanted to do, which was amazing because, again, you know, parents tend to guide their offspring sometimes in ways that, you know, are a little bit narrow. And so his father had this love and support for him. And then his father got, while Nick was in medical school, his father got cancer of the esophagus. And Nick was by his side and tried to help him, and there was no help. That's a very tough cancer. And at his bedside, he vowed that he was someday going to find a cure for cancer. And this was in his head from then on. And there was a really interesting drive because he lost his father when Nick was so young that he then, I watched this kind of unfold while I was putting his life together. He worked with a whole series, a succession of mentors, male mentors that became like father figures to him, who helped him significantly. I mean, they really pulled him along in terms of even like the clinical trial, and you have to raise all this money, and then, you know, all the attacks that he got, and he would call one or the other up, and they would talk him through it, you know, because even when I was a patient sitting there, I'd think, how does this guy hold up to all of this? You know, because I would read I would watch TV, read things, and there he was. And then they were making him out to be like a total quack. And I'm like, this is a man sitting across from me in a three-piece suit with a summa cum laude degrees in medicine and Ivy League university. And they're making him out like he's a total nut. And I thought, this is just horrible. How does he deal with this? And then I saw, when I did more research, that he did have this support team. And, you know, it was not easy.
No, Dr. Gonzalez definitely faced enormous resistance. I'm curious, you just told the story about you realized that he had mentors helping him. Did you ever see moments personally where it took a toll on him that you could see visibly in his office?
Yeah, no. He had mood, he had little mood swings that I noticed, and they weren't like, this man is a depressive or anything. I just knew he was under terrible pressure. And sometimes I would go in there and he would just like, you know, what are you writing? He was like guiding me through my whole writing career. And other times, and I could see, you know, that whatever was going on was driving him nuts. And, you know, so I just thought he was one of the greatest human beings to stand up to all that. Cause I just knew, I knew when he went into that clinical trial, I was just like, oh, please, please deliver him from this. Because I'd had my own experiences with the medical model. And I thought that this is not going to work. But I mean, it would be great if we could get through it. And then, you know, and then it, I knew those appointments that I had that, it was crashing. So
he certainly went into it with great optimism because he was getting such success in his own office. He thought, well, of course, I'll be able to prove this.
Yeah, and he was presenting cases, you know, to the NIH. He was getting standing ovations in Europe when he presented these, you know, cases. And I mean, my favorite chapter to write about in the book was he was invited to present cases in Switzerland by the former director of the Pasteur Institute. And he got over there and he was just, you know, applauded by all of these great doctors and minds in Europe. And they just thought he was absolute genius. And, you know, he was on this stage and he was in this beautiful country and he was in this hotel looking out on the Alps. Everything was going great. And then he gave one of his lectures, which there was no pause. There was no notes. There was no nothing. And, you know, that he could just talk, as you know, for 6 or 8 hours straight without a drink of water. And so I assume he'd done that. And then, you know, he was finished. People were asking him, just peppering him with questions. And then they slipped him a little note that said, you need to call your office right away. Emergency. And he was like, I'm sorry, you know, I've got to go. I've got to, you know, make this phone call. And the phone call was from his assistant saying, the State Medical Board of New York is here and they're confiscating your records and they're going to take away your license. And that's the way his whole life, when I get into the biography, was like, he would have this great success, but nobody would believe him. And then they try to get rid of him one way or another. And then the story actually continues. That's, as I said, it's my favorite part of the book. They sent him to some like doctor rehab facility way up in upstate New York where they send wayward doctors, you know, who I don't know what they're doing, but they sent him there and they gave him this whole battery of tests. It went on for like a week or something. And at the end of the thing, the director of the facility called him in and said, now, why are you here? And Nick said, politics. And the director said, you've aced every single test. The only thing we can possibly fault you for is you have terrible handwriting. I don't know how anybody can read any prescription you write. So they made him try to improve his handwriting, and then they sent him home.
Great story. So, Mary, what do you think people misunderstand the most about Dr. Gonzalez, even now?
Two words, coffee enema.
Tell me more.
This is just the stupidest thing. I mean, even when I talk to people who call me, I used to have one or two calls a month from people who were curious about the program, wanted him to see them, you know, wanted more information. And I said, well, and then, of course, you'll need to do coffee enemas, you know, and coffee enema, I researched that. And it was in the Merck manual until like 1978 something. And the folklore on it is that it was used by Florence Nightingale. We never were able to tack that down. But the folklore is, and Nick told me this, that it was used by Florence Nightingale to treat pain for soldiers. I mean, it was in common use, and Nick researched this himself, and he went to the editors of Merck, and they said, why'd you take it out of the manual? And they said, oh, no reason, we just for space. We had to put in all these other drugs and things, so we took that out. And that just freaks people out. And when I was, before I went on the program, I thought about it too, and I thought, My I had done so many weird things by that time, and it was like, oh, coffee enema. But my question to myself was, where are you going to fit this into your day? Because I was one of those weird people. I don't think he had many patients like this, where I worked full time, more than full time, and also was on the program. So I was like, where is this going to land? And finally, I looked at my schedule and I was like, okay, so I usually read about an hour before I fall asleep at night. And I was like, okay, we're going to shift that hour to these coffee enema times, and I'm going to do my reading then. And that was all I had to do. I just had to rearrange my life a little bit. And I find them like really nothing. It's nothing. They're very relaxing. And I was able to tell this within months of being on the program. Like when I was stressed, when I was like kind of toxic, because, you know, in the beginning, you're getting rid of all these toxins. And I was like, okay, time to do the coffee enema. And it's always been my friend. But there's so much, you know, negativity about it from the medical model. I'm like, you guys had it in your protocol until 1978 in the Merck manual, but people forget that.
Well, Mary, can you please take us back to what was happening in your own health when you first sought out Dr. Gonzalez?
I was filled with fibroid tumors, and I was really having a terrible time. I was basically bleeding to death. And I had gone to 9 different physicians, clinics, everything. And they would just shrug their shoulders and say, well, you don't have cancer. I'm like, yeah, I don't have cancer, but I'm like bleeding to death. I can hardly function. I can hardly stand up. I'm turning blue. And you know, it was like, you know, you don't have cancer. That's it. Goodbye. And that was more than frustrating. Plus, I'm self-supporting, so I'm trying to work full time. And it was just a drag. And then I had a good, this is kind of how the Gonzalez program works. And then I had a good friend who had a good friend in Colorado, and she had cancer, and there were a whole group of women. They were scientists, and they'd all had breast cancer. And none of them were getting any better. In fact, one of them I know had spread to stage 4, and she had it all up in her brain and everything else. And so they, as scientists, they said, okay, there's got to be something else. There's got to be a way that we can get over it. And they were in their 40s. They weren't elderly. And they had a lot to live for, and they had children and careers and books that they'd written, all everything. And so they sat down and they researched and they found Dr. Gonzalez. And at that time, he was in that tiny little office in somebody else's office in this little hole in the wall thing, you know. And and he was all crammed in there and had all of his books, and you know, it was pretty funny. But anyway, they found him in there, and all started going to him, and all got great help. And even the woman that had stage 4, he cleaned it out of her brain. And as far as I know, she's still alive. And so friend of the friend came to me, and this is a little bit confusing, but I had a friend who had stage 4 cancer. And so my friend Connie came to me and said, Mary, this might be something, you know, that your friend could look at, because she'd had a bone marrow transplant, just, you know, really rough stuff. And I said, well, what is it? And she brought me a little article that had been written about Dr. Gonzalez in a health food magazine or something. And I sat down and I started reading. I was like, oh my gosh, this man is on. Yeah, I think he's on to something. And so, you know, I mentioned it to my friend, but she was like, no, I'm doing my own thing. And, you know, I've learned to just go, okay, that's fine. And so then Connie came back to me and she said, what did your friend think? And I said, no, she's going to pass. I said, but maybe he can help me. And she was like, we don't have cancer. I said, yeah, but this guy knows how to get rid of tumors. And that's my problem. So I'm going to see if he can help me. And then, of course, I didn't understand that I had to like apply. It was like applying to Harvard or something. I had to send all sorts of things, records. I don't know if there was a questionnaire. It was a long thing. And then I had to have an interview. And then I had this very militant assistant that he had at the time, who was like trying to discourage people. I know now why she was doing that, because he didn't want people that were just going to like come to see him for a day and think, you know, I'm going to go on this for a week and then be cured. She, you know, she was trying to convey that it's a very rigorous protocol.
And she's also trying to convey that they don't want to give any false hope.
Right.
So they want to completely review the patient's situation. And then if the doctor thinks that the patient could actually benefit from this protocol, that's when they get accepted. Otherwise, it really isn't fair.
No, that's true. She said, well, you know, we have to gather all these materials and then we'll tell you if the doctor thinks he can help you. And I thought, well, okay, that's okay. That's fine. I've gone to all these other doctors who clearly knew they couldn't help me and I had to pay the money anyway. So I'm waiting there, you know, home in Iowa. And then I finally got the call. He said, yes, he thought that he could help me. I'm like, oh, glory, hallelujah. I was so sick, though. I had to have a friend, like, put me on the plane, come with me, and, you know, like, get me from, I remember getting from the hotel into the cab, into his office. I thought, I don't even make it. I'm so sick. And then I made it into his office. By this time, he had this beautiful new office. I think that was fairly new at the time. And then he starts asking me the same questions. And I thought, oh, no, I thought I was in. And he was like, huh, yeah, you know, he's checking down the list. And he goes, you don't have any support at home. And I thought, oh, he's going to throw me out because I live alone. He's going to throw me out. And I said, I was just totally honest. I said, no, I have a dog. And and he was like, oh, okay, that's good. At least you got a dog. He said, but you don't have anybody telling you not to do this. I said, no, I don't have anybody like that at all. And he was like, all right, good. We'll go forward. And then, you know, and then he took all the hair samples and he's just like, this is a really bad profile. I said, I told you I was sick. And he goes, and then I thought, oh, now he's going to throw me out again. And he was like, man, look at this cholesterol. It's like terrible. We got to get that up. And he's like banging his fist on the table. I went, oh no, now he really is going to throw me out. And I looked at him. I said, now listen, I might have bad test scores, but I am convinced that if I get on your program, I'm going to be okay. And I said, what you're not understanding is underneath this, I have a very strong constitution and I will do this program like down to the T. And he looked at me and he said, strong constitution, you're only half dead, but you're telling me you have a strong constitution. I said, I'm telling you that. And then it was like, I think it was like 5 years later when my scores had come way up. I mean, he was like, wow, look at this hemoglobin. This is like a weightlifter's hemoglobin. Now you know, this is fantastic. He was going through the scores like, all right, really good. And I said, yeah, remember when I came in the first day? And he said, well, you were right. You have a very strong constitution. So he remembered that exact line.
Oh, he remembers everything. So, okay, so you have your first meeting with Dr. Gonzalez, and he explains to you what's required of the protocol. Aside from the coffee enemas, which we just discussed, what was your honest first reaction to all that was going to be required of you?
This is really interesting because I didn't care what was going to be required of me. After I met him for the first time, his office was down this long, long hallway. And you sit in the waiting room all by yourself because nobody overlaps. And you just hear these shoes go click, 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 click. And then he meets you in the waiting room. And he met me and he said, I don't know, I'm Dr. Gonzalez. He said, you have a terrible neck injury. He said, it's just awful. We got to address that first. And then tonight you got to go out and have a steak and mashed potatoes. And I'm like, I like the sounds of this guy, because I had been in a really bad car accident and I could not get any attention to my neck injury. And I'd been to University of Iowa clinics. I went to Georgetown University's undergraduate, went all through their clinics. I'd been sent to specialists by both of those clinics. And it was the same thing. They just shrugged their shoulders and they go, well, your neck's not broken. Well, it turns out it was. And they were just not, it finally took a physical therapist to read the x-ray and go, oh, you know, you had a little fracture right there and more. And, you know, a whole wad of injuries that I won't bore you with. But he saw that right off the bat. And I'm like, how did he even know that? And that was picked up on the hair sample.
So at that point, he recommended that you do the Atlas orthogonal work,
correct? That's right.
So for those people who are unfamiliar with the Atlas orthogonal chiropractic work, can you explain what it is and the role that it played in your healing journey?
Yeah, it's actually a kind of chiropractic, but it's completely different from what you traditionally think of an adjustment is. And it's an adjustment just to the atlas, to one vertebra. And when that's out, then your whole spine can get all crunched up. And so Dr. Roy Sweat, who was in Atlanta, worked with some engineers at Georgia Tech and invented a computerized machine that, it was, again, this was like a brilliant guy that you got a special x-ray and then he fed in the vectors from that x-ray and then he operated the machine. So you basically, what you would feel was just like somebody taking their finger and going like this on your neck and then the adjustment would like straighten up your whole spine. And of course, Dr. Gonzalez was like, as soon as you get that steak and potato, I want you to get on another plane and go down to Atlanta and see this doctor, which I did. And it was pretty dramatic. My first adjustment, especially, it was like, whoa, this is what I've been walking around with. And so he got my neck straightened up. I had to continue with that. I would make the rounds. I would go, I would do it in the opposite way eventually. I would go down to see Dr. Sweat, and then I'd take another plane to New York and see Nick, because then I could bring the x-rays or whatever it was with me. And Nick had spent a long time with Dr. Sweat going over all the patients that he saw. I mean, he approached it with total skepticism in the beginning. It's just that Dr. Kelly had patients that got stuck and they weren't moving beyond a certain point. And then he found that some of them had gone to Dr. Sweat and it like improved their whole system. And so Nick's not a true believer in anything unless he, you know, has seen it, been and experienced it himself and so forth. And so I can't remember how long he was there, but he spent a lot of time with Dr. Sweat. Dr. Sweat said to me, yeah, that Nick, he asked a lot of questions. And so he understood the whole process very, very, very much. So anyway, I made the rounds there for years and years. And then one of Dr. Sweat's students, amazingly enough, set up practice here in Iowa, and then I would see him and he would do the vectors, and then he would consult with Sweat and do the adjustment. And so that went on like 30 years. I saw an Atlas orthogamy chiropractor.
It's pretty incredible work. I had direct help from it myself. And for those listening, I'll put in the show notes a directory to where to find the actual doctors who've been officially trained in this work so that you can hopefully find one in the area where you live. Of course, you can still go to Atlanta, even though Dr. Roy Sweat has passed away. his son, Matt, is carrying on the work and running the clinic. So, Mary, back to your own personal story. Was there ever a moment whether you doubted whether you could do this work? Because it is quite rigorous. And if you did ever doubt it, what made you stay consistent?
When I first got home, you know, and I was setting up everything, because you have to have certain foods, you have to have this and that. You know, there's a lot of things you need to have on hand. You have to order some things. You have to, you know, get yourself set up in it. And I just kept thinking, like, I thought about the coffee enema, and I was like, okay, when am I going to do this? And then I had to just, again, rearrange my life so that I was doing it. And other things did not get in the way. And, you know, I had to cut a lot of things out of my life. I didn't have much of a social life, that's for sure. But what I saw was my tumors shrink down, and I would go to Gonzalez and he'd say, well, what's your gynecologist think now? And I said, oh, she thinks that those are just spontaneous events and they're just shrinking on their own and I don't tell her different. And he's like, yeah, spontaneous events. And, you know, so that kept me going and I just started feeling so much better. And I still, even from good friends, you know, I have people go, you don't need to do that anymore. You're fine. And I said, I'm not messing it up now. No, thank you. You know, I know what I would be feeling like if I weren't on this, because you're on packets of supplements. I'm on like 15 days on, 5 days off. When I hit those 5 days off, I don't feel as well at all. I'm like, oh, goody, when do I get to go back on? this is not fun. And what the supplements do is they even out your metabolism and so that you're balanced. And I'm like, in his system, I am like, was born pretty much out of balance. And, you know, most people are balanced and they can get themselves out of balance by eating poorly and stuff like that. And I was just born out of balance. And so I'm like, no, you don't understand. This is what's allowing me to work full time, to do all of these things, to, you know, enjoy life. And I'm not going to mess it up now.
And how many years has it been?
So I think I've been on it 30 years now, which is amazing to me. I mean, and, you know, I've talked to so many people that, as I say, used to call me and beg me to call him to get them on the program. A couple people I did. And they'd say, how am I ever going to do all this? I said, well, you have to understand there is something that needs to be done, if not every hour, every couple hours. And I said, yeah, it can be a little overwhelming in the beginning, but then it just becomes like a natural part of my day. I just, you know, have these little alarms that go off. I'm like, oh, time to take that supplement, ding, ding, you know, and that one. And I just take it in my stride now, and I hardly ever mess up. So it's all good.
Mary, you were just mentioning about balance, and I'd like you to explain what that actually means for you and what your Gonzalez metabolic type was and how you then actually explored how to confirm it with your own research.
Yeah. When I first saw Dr. Gonzalez and he said, need to go out and get a steak and baked potato, he was telling me to eat like an alkaline person. And I didn't even know what that meant. But he had a spectrum, a continuum of what's called metabolic types. And these are kinds of structures in the human body. I mean, it's kinds of structures that everybody has a different chemistry. And actually, you know, this seems so weird to people, but I actually grew up, my grandfather was a doctor who, believe it or not, studied with Dr. Beard in Edinburgh in Scotland. This is true. biology. I found his transcripts, and he had biology, I'm pretty sure, from him. And now Beard didn't know metabolic types, but in those days, everybody knew that people had different chemistry. And when I was a kid, my mother said, now, you're going to have to be kind of careful because you clearly have your father's chemistry. And my father just had like a battled a weight problem his whole life. And he had a bunch of allergies and different things like that. And I thought, oh, great. And then I had like a tall, skinny brother. And she was like, he has my chemistry. I'm like, oh, well, I get into this. And so people could see that. People could divide the world that way in those days. And we lost all that when it was just like a pill for every ill. And so anyway, the spectrum is most people are balanced. Some people can get pushed into the acid zone or born in the acid zone. And those are those tall, thin people that are athletic and really good at math and like to organize things. As that brother of mine said, I am a really good manager and you are the creative one. Don't talk to me about any creative projects. And I'm like, ah. And then you can also be born alkaline. And those are the super creative, kind of messy people that are out of the box. And there are poets, there are visual artists. They all like the artist is the archetype for them. The accountant is the archetype for the acid people. So the whole theory is you need to be balanced. And if you start going either direction or if you're born in either direction, you're going to have some problems to confront. And that's when you're going to be more vulnerable to illness. And that could be cancer, it could be autoimmune. And actually, Nick found that most autoimmune people are in the alkaline camp. Now, my steak and baked potato thing, Nick then looked at me and he's behind his desk. Then he's like, oh, he said, you are really alkaline. And, you know, and he's looking at this and he said, now you're not an Inuit. And I'm like, what is he talking about? I'm not an Inuit. Clearly I'm not an Inuit. And he said, no, your ancestry is really, really far north, Northern European. I'm like, okay. But he really meant far north. And he said, we got to get you back. You know, we got to pull you back. And the way you counteract alkaline is meat, poultry, fish, fat. And that pulls you in more toward the balanced side of things. For acid people, the way to counteract that is vegetarian. Fruits. My friend with the breast cancer and the hard tumor cancers are usually acid people. And she's just on like almost a fruitarian diet. I went to visit her once. She didn't understand what my type was. And she like presented me with this huge fruit basket. I'm not allowed to eat any fruit at all. I'm like, what are we doing here? And she's like, I'm bringing you Gonzalez diet. I'm like, that's your diet. That's not mine. And so that's really confusing to people too, because most doctors, no matter what they are, MDs, functional medicine doctors, chiropractors, they put, oh, you're sick. You need a vegetarian diet. And that is the most dangerous thing you could do to somebody like me. And a lot of doctors that I saw did that to me. And so the genius behind this is realizing that everybody has a little bit different, needs a little bit different diet, has special needs that need to be addressed. And because I started out what was called moderate carnivore diet, but because I'd been in the car accidents, it pushed me even further to the alkaline scale. So as far as I can gather, I was like the freak of his practice that was like the furthest alkaline patient that he had, because then he had me on extreme, which I'm still on, extreme alkaline diet, so I just carry around little cans of sardines with me because that's like the best remedy that I know. If I'm starting to feel sick, I open one of those and I'm like, okay, there we go. Helps a lot. So if you get something like 12 basic diets with 99 variations.
And it wasn't just diet necessarily. Yeah. So once somebody was metabolically typed and you were on the parasympathetic dominant side, that also influenced the type of supplementation yeah. that you were given. Most likely, I'm going to suggest it was more calcium, certainly, than some of the more sympathetic dominant patients. And also your detox plan was tailored to your metabolic type. So it's more than just diet. And that's something that I really want people to understand, because sometimes people want to just be told, well, what do I have to eat in order to cure my cancer? And there's just a lot more to it than that. So tell me a little bit more about how you documented your ancestry to confirm your parasympathetic dominance.
So I wanted to write an article about it, about this whole experience. And I thought, well, Nick is telling me I'm from this ancestry. And I knew my ancestry, to like we all do, up to a point, you know, grandparents, great-grandparents. But I don't know anything further than that. I'm just guessing. My mother was Irish from pretty far up north in Ireland. And my father was Swiss German. And his German part was up by the North Sea. And I thought, okay, that's a good start. But Nick's telling me, nah, he said, it's not in the Arctic Circle. You didn't come from within the Arctic Circle, but really close to that. And so I thought, well, okay, I'm gonna just spit in the tube. And I sent off for my ancestry printout. And what came back was Viking. And yeah. And I'm like, and it was actually really funny, because it was all really, really far north, Siberia, you know, all this kind of stuff. And I'm like, wow, gee. And so it was a combination, you know, of course, of both parents, but it was also the civilizations that had actually conquered or interbred with those countries that I knew I was from. And so it raised me up even further. I was like, wow, this is just amazing. And then there were some little wild cards in there that I thought, where'd that come from? Didn't know. And then I thought, this is not scientific, what you're doing here, Swander. You're sending your spit in a tube to one company, and then you're going to rely on that to write this article. That's not verifying anything. So I sent it again to a different company, as I thought, let's just check on this. And it came back just exactly the same way. And, you know, and when I told this to Nick, he was like, you didn't have to spit in a tube. I could have told you, you know, what the deal was. And then, this is so funny, I go to Ireland frequently. And one time when I was there, I was sitting in a pub and I was listening to that. I teach a class, an ecology class there in the summer. And it was the most wonderful thing. It was like full of scientists. And then it was like me to, you know, to do the creative bit. And they were talking about, it's on the West Coast where my family is from. And they were talking about how the Vikings came down the West Coast and, you know, interbred with people there. And the look of those people, and the whole thing, like how different those people were from that. And I just sat there and I went, okay, this explains a lot. I mean, it was an interesting day. So
it sounds like that helped deepen your trust in the protocol, because you saw firsthand.
It did.
Now, many people don't know what you know, which was that a high percentage of Dr. Gonzalez's patients also saw him for autoimmune diseases, not just cancer. So I'm curious, as you did your research and interviews with some of his patients for the book, what did you see in some of his patients who were not dealing with cancer?
Well, first of all, I don't think him treating us, the autoimmune people, was like on his radar in the very beginning. He was, as I said, totally focused on finding a cure for cancer. And then people like me just start calling him up and saying, can you help me? And, he, you know, after this review and everything, your application, he would take us on. And he told me at one point, clearing up cancer is piece of cake compared to dealing with autoimmune disease. And I thought, because it was not like a snap for me. It was a rough ride in parts of it. And I had, you know, I had the car accidents and all that that were just like really holding me back. And so I, you know, when I started working on the book, I heard from people that had Lyme disease. And that was one of the most dramatic healing stories that I researched for the book. You know, the cancer stories were incredible. I mean, people had like pancreatic, stage 4 pancreatic cancer, and they were told they had 6 weeks to live. And it was 20 years later. I interviewed this gentleman in St. Louis who was in real estate, and he owned 18 apartment buildings, and he had liver cancer, and he was told to divest everything. He sold 18 buildings, and then his mother was like, you are not going to die. We're going to find you something that's going to save your life. And she basically dragged him by his hair onto an airplane to get him to New York to see Dr. Gonzalez. And this, again, this was it was at least 20 years later that he was cleared up. But there was one family in particular that I remember with Lyme disease. And Lyme disease is, if you haven't had it or you haven't had a loved one with it, you have no idea. It's just a pervasive illness that can affect everything from your mood to your joints to your digestion. It's just, and you don't know what is what sometimes. And again, the medical model is a little bit better now, but at the time that these people were dealing with it, you know, it was just all in your head. You're making it up. You know, so you had that bias to deal with. So anyway, I remember this family, and the entire family had Lyme. And I think they lived right there in Connecticut in a really vulnerable place. But every place is vulnerable now because it's spread all over the place. And it was parents, and as I remember it, 2 to 3 children. And they were all bedridden. All of them. The whole family was bedridden. And I said, oh, my goodness, how in the world did you ever survive that? You know, and not only you have care of children to deal with, but you have financial problems. You have, you know, you have to get food on the table. I mean, you have every single problem in the world, but everybody's sick. And so, and the mother, I believe, came first. And then she did take the oldest daughter, or the two of them, I think, you know, eventually got together. And he got them cleared up. And then the father came, and he was very, 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 nobody was working. I don't know. I asked her, how did you do this? And I think they were quickly going through their savings. You know, it was the whole bit. And then they got the father cleared up. And then they started working down. They got another kid cleared up. And then they had the youngest kid. And he was pretty young. And Dr. Casas didn't want to work on kids because there are a lot of reasons, but the kid didn't want to do, as I remember, he didn't want to do the coffee enema. So they worked out some compromise where he did it like once a week, and they got him through it. And the whole family got back on their feet. It was a remarkable story. I mean, they could have all just faded into the sunset if they hadn't had Dr. Gonzalez. And I remember when I was patient in his office, he mentioned Lyme to me, and he was like, now that's a difficult one. You know, I remember him shaking his head going, whoa, that is really, really an autoimmune disease to tangle with.
We are so fortunate that one of our Gonzalez certified doctors today specializes in treating Lyme, and she's based in Connecticut. And so we have a lot of patients going to see her doing the Gonzalez protocol. I'm curious, Mary, why do you think that this work has such broad application beyond cancer? You know, Lyme disease, other autoimmune, why do you think it works?
That's it. We're so trained in the medical model protocol that, you know, cancer, you do chemo or radiation. Autoimmune disease, we don't know what to do. We just like give you painkillers, maybe. Like I never had a painkiller ever. It was in terrible, terrible pain. And, you know, it was just like a shrug of the shoulder. Well, you don't have cancer, so get out of here. And the way we really need to look at the human body is the human body is a wonderful, wonderful organism that, given the right conditions, will right itself, is basically the deal. And it doesn't matter, you know, we divide everything into, well, is this kind of this and this kind of that. It doesn't matter. I mean, before I even went to Gonzalez and I was like doing my own little research, I'd go to the med library and sit in there all night and start reading on this. And I thought I was only, I think, 30 years old at the time. And I thought all these autoimmune diseases are the same thing. It's just that the body, you know, goes out of whack, you know, and then it can go into lupus. It can go into rheumatoid arthritis. It can go into all these different things, but it's basically the same dysfunction. I was right. How's that for an English major? And so the whole idea is to improve the state of health of the body as a whole. And that's, you know, that's where we get into these ideas of holistic medicine and everything. But it's actually a returning to that viewpoint. As I said, that was with us a long, long, long time ago. We're the weird ones. We're the ones that forgot about that idea. And different cultures throughout the world have had that knowledge. And so, you know, it's not divide and conquer anymore. It's like enhance and grow healthier.
So we've been talking for a while now, and I think it's clear that the protocol, as we've been describing it, it asks a lot of people. And I'm curious, from your 30-year perspective, what separates those who succeed from those who quit?
Well, you have to be kind of driven to do the program. And I think people are driven in different ways. You know, there's a brilliant, brilliant book by a Holocaust survivor, Man's Search for Meaning. And what is that thing in life that keeps you wanting to keep living is the question. And it can be family, it can be work, it can be a spiritual connection. And so I think that's what it was for me. I had many of those things in my life that I was like, no, I don't want to die at 40. I got a lot of things to do. I got books I want to write and read, and, you know, things I want to enjoy and so forth. And so there was that. And then there was also, I lost my grandmother and my mother within 5 years when I was 20, 15 and 20. And they both died of cancer. And I was my mother's sole caretaker. And it was, my grandmother was 82 and there wasn't much treatment and she just kind of faded out. My mother, man, she got slugged with all sorts of chemotherapy and mustard gas. And it was just horrific. And I was so young, I didn't know what I was doing half of the time. But what I came away with that was, I'm not going there. I do not want to end up like that. That was just a total, complete nightmare. And so people would say, what are you doing this for? I said, I don't want to die like my mother did. And so that was one of the things that, you know, I had in front of my face. And I think it was pretty similar to Nick, in that his quest to cure cancer was related to his relationship with his father. So I think people have a personal stake in it. And then I also, you know, I had the friend of the friends, these women scientists, who all got better from pretty serious cancers. And I thought, okay, this thing works. So I just gotta get with it, program. And then once I got on the program, as I said before, anytime I stepped off of it, even within the protocol, I felt worse. And I didn't want to feel any worse than I had to. So that kept me on it too.
You mean like for those 5-day breaks?
5-day breaks always feel so much worse. And so that's why I said, I'm just like, oh, goody, day 6, I'm back on the wagon. And then, you know, when I was doing the book, I talked to so many like totally cool people. You know, I didn't have Nick anymore. And so, but I had all these people that I interviewed, which was really wonderful. And there was a nurse, and she was in New York City. I can't remember quite. I think she had liver cancer. It was a bad one. And she lived alone, and she was like me, she was self-supporting. She had to keep working. And she started the Gonzales program. I said, well, if you were a nurse, why did you start the Gonzales program? I think you'd done something more conventional. She said, no, I was a nurse on an oncology ward, and I knew what was going to be done to me if I went in that direction. I said, well, that's great. And she was one of his early, early first patients. I think she's in the new, you know, the pictures in the New Yorker article. I think she's one of those people. That's my guess anyway. Anyway, I said, well, you know, there was a new program. He was in that little hole of an office, you know, that this is completely not medical model. I said, what gave you the strength to stay on the program, to do it and stay on it? She said, now, honey, I had been a nun. And I'm like, and she said, so I knew all about fasting and torture and self-deprivation. She said, so the Gonzales program was like nothing to me. I was like, oh, this woman is hilarious. But I kind of had a similar experience, because I grew up very observant Catholic, and we did all of that. You know, we fasted until we fainted in church, you know, waiting for communion, because it'd be like, I don't know, I can't remember what, there were certain hours, and then they would shorten them as the years went on. But we had to be fasting, I think, for at least 12 hours or something like that. Anyway, we went through all of that drill. And so I was used to, okay, looking at my watch, are we ready yet? We're ready to do this. And so it's kind of your background. It's your drive. It's your search for meaning. A lot of people, as I said, I didn't have this, but a lot of people have to fight off their families, because they're all like, no, 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 no. Why are you doing that crazy thing? We're going to take you right in, get you a chemo shot. You know, they have to like fight off that kind of static, which I didn't have at all. I breezed through all of that. So that was huge. And then when I do get some of that from just my friends, I just tell them, I'm not going to screw it up now. Don't ask me to mess this up at this point. Thank you very much. Goodbye.
Mayor, I'd like to get back to your award-winning book, The Maverick MD, Dr. Gonzales' official biography. And I'd like to hear from your perspective, what do you really hope people take away after reading The Maverick MD?
I wanted to write the book the way I did because I wanted two things. I wanted a portrait of a genius who created this protocol that essentially can change American health. And I also wanted a deeper understanding of the protocol, what the history of it was. Because I knew it, but I had to pick it up hither and yon and watched videos of him talking and, you know, and being in his office twice a year for 20 years and asking him questions. But there was no, and he had written, of course, all these wonderful books, but they were more scientifically oriented. And I wanted a book that was accessible. And also that would show it's not, it has a long ancient tradition tied to it in terms of the components, the metabolic types, the diet, even the exercise. Like, because of my metabolic type, I'm not supposed to do any heavy aerobic exercise. Like he said, walking is the best thing for you. And so all of those things, I wanted like a back, people to have the background in it, something easy to read, something that would be engaging. And, you know, a lot of people say, oh, this reads like a thriller, or, you know, this is really involving. And I thought, okay, that's good. That's exactly what I want, because so many books, like medical books, are just like, they're so vague, you can't figure out what they're trying to say. Or they're so pedantic that you like, you get to page five, and, you know. And so I tried to bring my nonfiction writing skills to the page to bring some energy into it and some depth.
I especially liked how, given your experience as an award-winning playwright, each chapter reads like a scene. And you can really put yourself right in that situation. And of course, you know, we both have talked about how we hope it's a movie someday. And it's literally written like it could be, very easily.
Yeah, no, a scene, you know, people don't know, it's like the movie component of writing. It could be prose, it could be fiction, it could be nonfiction. Playwriting is all scene. And it's the thing that has the action, the dialogue, the involvement with people or animals, whatever it is, in a setting. And so for each chapter, I try to think, okay, what is the key scene in this? That's the way I've learned to write books. It's like, okay, what is this chapter about? And what's the key scene? Like I talked about that my favorite scene was when he was lecturing in Switzerland. They were taking his medical license away in New York. And yeah, it's just the absurdity of that. But it makes a great scene, and it allows the audience to see, oh, this is how it works. You know, you can have this great research and protocol developed, and, you know, back in home court, nobody understands it, and they think you're doing something horrible with your patients. So that's the energy behind the book. You're right.
Now, if Dr. Gonzalez were here today, what do you think he would want people to understand the most about healing?
This is so interesting, because once, you know, the thing about your appointments with him is he took a whole hour with you, which is really, really remarkable. I mean, I'm used to 7 minutes. That's what you get here. You get 7 minutes. And he took a whole hour with you to really, he's trying to understand you and the way you functioned and your way you thought and so forth. Anyway, he always said, do you have any questions? And I remember saying to him, so do you think like the nutritional program part of this is the strongest part? Or do you think the psychological part is the strongest part? Or you do think the spiritual element is the strongest part? And he said, well, that's the question I asked Kelly. Once I asked him, you know, which part do you think is strongest? And Kelly looked at me and he said, well, it's 100% nutritional. I said, oh, really? Okay. And then he turned around and he said to me, no, it's not. It's 100% psychological. Oh, that's interesting. And then he was walking out the room and he yelled back at me, no, it's 100% spiritual. And so I kind of like held on to that. I was like, okay, you need all three things at their fullest dimension to work this program.
Well, Mary, if somebody is listening right now who is struggling, these are the people we want to help. They may be overwhelmed and they may not be sure if they have it in them to keep going. So as this patient now for 30 years on the Gonzalez Protocol, doing it so successfully, what would you say to those people?
Well, I would say, you know, just hang in there. And one thing you can do is get in touch with, you know, somebody who's had success with it. I always had that. I could call one of those people that I knew had been on the program and had great success. And I only did that maybe two times, but it was enough. In all those years, it was enough to say, okay, they're doing it. Just keep going. They're having great success. Just keep going. And then, you know, and I'm not a big believer in support groups and all of that. Just like one person that you can actually connect with is good enough for me. And then the other thing is you can ask for some help. I always thought, well, I got to do this all myself. And I've got all these cups out and, you know, all these pills. Blah, 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 blah. There was a period when I couldn't get out of bed. I mean, it was a car accident thing again. And I talked to Gonzalez on the phone. He's like, you got to stay on the program. You have to stay on the program. I said, I can't get out of bed to do my pills. And he goes, I don't care how you do it. Just stay on the program. And so I thought, oh, I am actually going to have to ask for some help, which is really hard for me. And that friend of mine, Connie, who had originally told me about the program, she came out to my place and she said, Mary, what do you need? I said, I need to stay on the program. And she said, oh, okay, where's your box of pills? And I'm like, let's get them out. And she got all the cups out and she went down the sheet and did my pills for like the next couple months all in one swoop. And that, you know, that was enough to help to, you know, I was so, so, so grateful for that. And that was enough help that got me through that hump. And so people might not believe it. They might still think you're wacko, but there's some good people out there that will help you with various parts of this. When I worked on the book, what was interesting to me was people's support system. Like the woman that I talked about who was the nurse, I asked her, I said, okay, single woman, how did you handle this? And she said, I had a circle of about 8 to 10 really, really, really good women friends. And they just jumped in. And they were nurses, so they didn't believe in it. But they jumped in and said, if this is what you want to do, we're here to help you. Most of the men that were successful, all of them, really, I can't think of any other support. They had spouses or mothers. You know, there were several really determined mothers who were like, you are not going to die and we're going to figure this out. And as I said, they just put their offspring on a plane and got them to New York. The wives did all the pills and everything. Now, some problem with all of that too, because women basically usually don't have that kind of support, but nevertheless, they got it done. And that's what I would say. I'd say, don't be afraid to say, you know, could you come over for a couple hours and we could get this taken care of? And I even tell people, I said, just don't say anything detrimental about it. Let's just get the pills in the cups, okay? And that's what you got to do. You got to get the pills in the cups and then set your little alarm. When I first went on the program, Dr. Gonzalez sent out this little mimeograph sheet that one of his, I was only on it for about 6 months, and this sheet came, and it was one of his patients, and she had like set alarms on her watch to remind her to take the enzymes. And so that's what's hard to remember, those doses that aren't part of meals. And I found that really helpful. It's just like, ding, ding, okay, it's time for something, to take something, ding, ding, time for the limacium, whatever it might be. And just set up whatever reminders you need. And that really helps because, you know, your days can get away from you and you're not thinking, oh, I need to take this right now. So
I remember a lot of evenings at home on the couch talking to Nick after his long day. And, you know, he would typically get home between 8 and 9 o'clock on a weekday, and I'd have dinner ready. I had my own career, so I had already worked all day, but I knew a home-cooked meal was important. We would sit there on the couch, and we would talk about all the phone calls that he had made at the end of the day to the patients who had questions. And just trying to help, I would say to him, well, maybe it would be a good idea to set up some support groups for these patients. And he looked at me and he said, well, here's what happened when we did that. And of course, I heard the whole story. So when early on, when Nick would kind of match up patients with even the same diagnosis together to support each other, whether it was in person or over the phone, you know, there was no internet back then, inevitably, somebody always dragged the whole group down with all of their negativity. And inevitably, the rest of the group would show up for their next appointment with Dr. Gonzalez and say, well, Marcy's taking this supplement and she feels better and I'm not taking that one. Maybe I should be taking that. Or I'm taking this supplement, but, you know, Joe isn't. So why? And he said it led to so much more uncertainty amongst the patients and angst, because then they're trying to like console each other. It gave them like a whole other job. And it gave him a whole other job because he had to spend time in their patient session talking to them about why they're not doing what Marcy and Joe are doing, because it's all individualized. So when I first worked with the foundation to educate new doctors on how to do this protocol, you know, of course, all the doctors are saying, let's set up support groups. And I say, that is the last thing we're going to do. And here's why. But here's what we did do. And it's been working really well. We have some people who are who we call Gonzalez guides. And they are past patients who are past their difficult times. They're, you know, in remission, they're healthy, they're very educated about the protocol, and they help guide new patients. And then we also have some Gonzalez guides who were primary caregivers, like you were to your mom, who knew the program inside and out as a caretaker. And so they do this work both remotely, or if you they happen to live in your town, they'll come over and they'll help you organize your supplement. So those are people that are, especially our new patients, can hire for a short period of time. And, you know, the relationship is directly with them. And we found that it's been helpful. It's just like another tool in the toolbox to keep people organized and compliant, because, you know, not everybody feels comfortable calling their doctor every day when they have a question.
That is excellent. Like I, Dr. Gonzalez said, why did you call me? You never call me. You go for all 6 months. I never hear from you. And I'm like, I'm trying not to bother you. I mean, I know how busy you are. It's just incredible. I can't believe you're here till midnight answering phone calls and you don't need me. And he was just like, you know, he was like, not just the opposite. I need for you to check in at least every month. And I'm like, okay. So there's probably two kinds of patients. One that's calling him every night. I know that he had patients that called him every night. And then there are ones like me that are like, ooh, he's too busy. The one thing I did learn, though, just managing self-management, I think your system you've set up is fantastic. But I didn't self-doctor. I self-managed, but I didn't self-doctor. I don't add anything or I don't subtract anything from the program unless I called him specifically and I said, could I up the dose on, you know, my Bromelain or something. I always checked with him because he's got it really fine-tuned. He doesn't need you to muck it up. Is basically my thing. And then another thing was there were, you know, most of my friends were not enthusiastic, but there were a few that were super enthusiastic. And I remember I had the program on my refrigerator, you know, the sheets, because, you know, I was always looking at them, got to do the liver cleanse and this and that. And a friend of mine came over and she had had health problems. And she said, give me that. I want those sheets. You got to make a copy of those sheets for me. And I'm like, what are you talking about? And she said, all these supplements, I need this. I'm going to go on this same thing. And I'm like, no, you are not. And she said, no, I'm going to go and copy these right now. I'm going to go get the supplements. And I'm like, you don't even know what you're going on. I said, you could be totally a different metabolic type and this could kill you where it's healing me. And that was something that people, boy, they could not wrap their head around either. And finally, I convinced her. I was like, no, no. And I told Dr. Gonzalez that and he goes, oh, thank God you didn't let her do that. And I said, no, no. This is for me and me only. And that's, again, that's what's so different about the medical model where everybody just takes the same thing in the same dose. And good luck after that.
Well, Mary, this has been such a lovely time catching up with you and hearing your thoughts about the protocol today. And thank you again for the awesome job that you did writing his official biography. We're going to put a link in the show notes to people so you know how you can get this biography. But I just want to thank you again from the bottom of my heart.
Oh, thank you, Mary Beth. It's great. It's great working with you. And there's the little book up in the corner there, The Maverick MD. And you did such a nice job of producing it. And it was great working with you and doing this podcast today.
Thank you. Mary, this conversation is such a gift. Not just because of the story you've told, but because of the life that you've lived inside that story. Your experience brings something no study could ever do, proof. And for anyone listening, if this conversation sparks something in you, I encourage you to explore the Maverick MD and learn more about the work of Dr. Nicholas Gonzalez. Because sometimes the path back to health isn't about discovering something new. It's about having the courage to follow something all the way through. Until next time, this is Your Way Back.